Welcome to The Happy Writer. This is a podcast that aims to bring readers more books to enjoy and to help authors find more joy in their writing. I am your host, Marissa Meyer. Thank you for joining me. What is making me happy this week is that I have two special co-hosts joining me for this episode. They happen to be two of my favorite human beings on the planet, and they're going to help us talk about today's book. Girls, would you like to introduce yourselves?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I am Delaney.
And I am Sloane.
Mary Rose, are you able to hear them okay?
I am, okay. And I'm trying really hard not to chuckle with delight. You guys are so cute.
Chuckling with delight is completely allowed on this podcast.
Yes, chuckle. Thank you, girls, for helping us out. It's going to be so much better because you're here.
Yeah.
Yeah, full agreement.
And this is right next to Alice in my bunny picture.
That's right. The girls, we printed off some bunny coloring pages right before we started, so they are hard at work coloring. And I know that we both have an Alice and a thistle that we've colored.
Aw, isn't that wonderful?
I'll post everything on social media so everyone can know what we're talking about. Of course, we are all so happy to be talking to today's guest. She's the author of the acclaimed middle grade series, The Incorrigible Children of Ashton Place, and has written 7 novels for young adults, including My Life the Musical and Why I Let My Hair Grow Out. Her latest middle grade, Alice's Farm, A Rabbit's Tale, came out last year and will be available in paperback this week. Please welcome Mary Rose Wood.
Well, hello. Hi, Marissa. Thank you so much for having me on this podcast, which, by the way, has the best name, The Happy Writer. That I like those words. Those are good words.
I try to live up to it, too. It's important.
It is important. Writers get all stressed about so many things.
I know. No, and that was part of the catalyst for it is that, you know, it's so easy to get caught up in, publication drama and, you know, work and struggles and rejection and all of these things. And I thought, yeah, but you know what? It's kind of fun. Writing is fun. Let's focus on that.
It's fun. At the end of the day, we are storytellers. We are just storytellers. And I don't say just as if it's not an important job. I think being a storyteller is one of the most important jobs there is.
I agree. And one that I know I feel super honored to get to do and get to share stories with everybody.
Same.
So before we get into talking about Alice's Farm, which I've been reading with the girls and we are all really enjoying it, which is, of course, why they're joining me on this episode. But before we get into that, we had a really exciting event happen this morning that was surprisingly relevant to the book that we're going to be talking about.
Isn't it funny how things like that tend to happen?
I know. I'll let the girls tell the story so I don't spoil anything. Delaney, do you want to start with what happened this morning?
Yes. So when me and mommy were in the family room relaxing, waiting for Sissy to get up.
Oh, come over here so you're at the microphone, sweetheart.
Okay. When me and mommy and daddy were sitting in the family room this morning, waiting for Sissy to get up, we heard some rustling in our back by our room, and mama saw that JoJo had a little baby bunny in her mouth. So we chased JoJo away and we got the bunny in a carrying case. And after a while, we took her to our grandma's house and our grandma tried to give her some water or him. It could be a her or him. And Sunny, would you like to finish this story?
And its name was Thistle. We named it Thistle. And we are going to leave it alone until it feels comfortable in the carrying case and it's ready two come out of its hiding spot. It's hiding in its hiding spot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's been kind of burrowed down in the towel all day. Where did we get the name Thistle from?
From the bunny book.
Who wrote the bunny book?
More chuckling and delight coming from this end, by the way.
They're kind of looking at me like, I think I know the answer, but I'm not sure I want to say. Did Mary Rose that we're talking to write the bunny book and come up with Thistle? Yeah.
I did. And you know what's so wonderful? You guys call it the bunny book. That's what I call it too.
Oh, that's funny.
the whole time I was writing it, I just was like, you know, people would say, what are you doing? I said, oh, I'm working on this bunny book.
That.
And so everyone calls it the bunny, like everyone in my life, like, how's the bunny book going? Is the bunny book out yet? Oh, is the bunny book out in paperback? Yes, it is. So the bunny book. It's so cute.
It's a very natural thing to think of it.
It is.
Well, that was a very good rendition of what happened. We think Thistle is going to be okay. He's got a few owies because he was in a cat's mouth for a little while. But they don't seem to be fatal. We think he's going to be just fine.
Oh, good. That's a relief.
Yeah. And it was very exciting. It's been all anyone can talk about all day long.
Oh, absolutely. Well, thank you so much for naming this bunny Thistle. I think
It looks just like the bunny rabbit on the covers too, which is really fun.
There you go.
So with that, Mary Rose, why don't you tell listeners who aren't familiar with the bunny book, what is Alice's Farm about?
Oh, I'd be happy to. Well, yes, it's not really called the Bunny Book. It's called Alice's Farm, A Rabbit's Tale. And Alice and Thistle, the characters that you've heard mentioned, are brother and sister. They're two Eastern cottontails, and they live on a farm or in the area adjacent to an empty farm in the Hudson Valley, which is a beautiful area just north of New York City, for those of you who know the East Coast. And the farm has nobody in it. It hasn't had anybody in it for a couple of years. And of course, they're young rabbits, so a couple of years might as well be forever as far as they're concerned. And one day, a new family takes over the farmhouse. And this is a cause of great debate within the rabbit community, because on the one hand, not having farmers around makes life kind of peaceful because there's nobody out there, you know, with a shotgun trying to scare rabbits away from the, you know, the garden. And importantly, there are no farmers' dogs to bother them. As you guys learned this morning, sometimes house pets and wild rabbits, you know, don't always get along perfectly. So the experienced rabbits know that not having a dog around and not having a farmer around does make life peaceful. But some of the other experienced rabbits also know that not having a farmer around means that they don't get any good vegetables, that the miraculous carrots and lettuces and radishes and, you know, things that would not be growing wild are not available. And so life is a little bit less exciting without a farmer. So this is the, you know, opening situation of the book. These farmers arrive, and Alice is one of the young rabbits who is more excited and curious than cautious and wary. And so she and her brother Thistle sort of volunteer to go down and see what these new farmers are all about, and importantly, discover if they do have one of these dreaded dogs. And what they discover is that these new farmers are not particularly experienced farmers. In fact, they're not farmers at all. They're a family of what I would lovingly refer to as hipsters from Brooklyn. They're city dwellers, and they have a very idealistic dream of running a farm and returning to the land and, you know, having a simpler and more natural life. And they're full of hopes and dreams. And by the way, I'm calling myself out here as much as I'm, you know, calling out any fictional Brooklyn hipsters. This was me. This is totally me. Back in the day when my kids were young, I was like, oh, if only we could move to the country, you know, I could grow vegetables and write books. It would be so great. But here's the problem. You know, a failed farm is ripe territory. It's prey, one might say, for the local real estate developer. And Alice and Thistle sort of quickly discover that if these farmers fail, which they are very likely to do, the whole territory that is their shared home will be bulldozed. and turned into something not very hospitable to wild animals. And so they take it upon themselves, and Alice is really the hero here, to overcome what I guess we might call a very deep-seated prejudice against farmers. Because if you're a wild rabbit, the farmer is the enemy. But guess what? If you're a farmer, a rabbit is the enemy. And Alice realizes what the others don't, which is that if they fail, we're all going to lose our home. Mm. And she decides that they are going to have to do what no rabbit has ever done before and joins with the farmers, help the farmers. And Alice herself decides that the best way to do this is for them to learn to be farmers. And Alice and Thistle take on an incredible adventure, this huge task of making sure this farm succeeds in spite of the well-intentioned, but let's face it, incompetent farmers who've come up from Brooklyn to try to take it on. One of the things that they have to do, again, sort of hearkening back to your little Thistle's adventure this morning, is they have to learn how to work with the other animals, because, of course, this isn't just about rabbits. You know, there's a lot of different types of animals living in this valley. And if the farmland goes, then they all are impacted. But here's the thing about rabbits. They are prey animals. They are the bottom of the food chain, one might say, when it comes to carnivores. And so many of the other animals in the valley would consider rabbits food. And it takes tremendous amount of courage and tremendous leadership and persuasive ability from Alice to make deals and alliances with all of the other animals of the valley to help her effort to save them all, to save their collective home by doing what she's doing. So there's a lot of exploration of how interdependent we all are and how making friends, even if it's a strained friendship with one's perceived enemies, is sometimes what needs to happen in order to serve the larger good. Mm-hmm.
I think it is such a sweet book. And I loved how clever these rabbits are as they're trying to get this farm up and running and bringing in all of the other, well, where do we get seeds and how are we going to accomplish this? And I mean, all of it was just really fun to read about and to watch their adventures. And like I said, we've all been just really enjoying it.
Oh, I'm glad to hear it. You know, one of the questions that people always ask about any book, right, is, well, how do you know what happens next? Like, how do you come up with all the stuff? But you know, anybody who's ever farmed or even planted a vegetable garden knows that there are just certain things that have to happen. You know, you need seeds, you need to plant them, you need to fertilize them, you need to make sure they're weeded. And so it was really, for me, one is tempted to say, organic process. You see what I did there, Marissa? You see what I did? It was an organic process of imagining, well, what if I were a cottontail rabbit and I had to make a garden grow? Like, what exactly would I do? And so some of the questions that we ask as writers, we're always saying, what if, right? Mm-hmm. Well, what if I needed seeds? Like, they have to go to the chipmunks for seeds, right? Because right. Who's got more seeds than a chipmunk? I mean, that's what a chipmunk has, one job, to save seeds. That's what they do. And it was really fun to try to figure out, not necessarily how I would solve these problems, but how would Alice solve them? Yeah. What resources does she have available to make this happen? And it was really a lot of fun to come up with that stuff. And of course, I should say that this wonderful family, they're called the Harveys from Brooklyn. They do have a dog, but it is no ordinary farmer's dog.
Girls, what do we think about Foxy?
Foxy is a dog that looks like a fox. And that has a pigtail.
A pig, curly tail. Yes, like a pig.
Well, listen, that she's not like part dog, part pig. Although, you know, it doesn't take a literary critic to see that, you know, Charlotte's Web was a great source of inspiration for me in wanting to write a book set on a farm. But the reason that Foxy, the dog that belongs to the farmers, has a curly tail is because she's a Shiba Inu. Mm-hmm. And that is not a typical farmer's dog, but it is a dog that you might see on a leash walking the streets of the city. And as it turns out, you know, Foxy's never been off the leash at all. She's a city dog. So her story, the story of Foxy coming up to the country, is very much like a parallel to the experience of her humans who also have to learn how to live in the country. It's very different for them mm-hmm. than city life. And along with Alice, we also focus quite a bit in the book on Carl, who's the son of the Harvey family. And he is a very reluctant transplant. See what I did there, Marissa? Transplant.
You're full of them.
I'm full of them. He's a very reluctant transplant to the country. He's at first just really opposed to this crazy notion that he thinks his parents have lost their minds. Like, why would we ever leave Brooklyn? You know, why would we want to go to a farm? But he ends up falling in love with it. And he goes on quite a journey of transformation himself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I really loved just what a great variety of characters there were. And Foxy in particular was one of my favorites because, you know, she's so kind of highbrow and, you know, very much a pampered city dog. And of course, I try to come up with voices for all the different characters while I'm reading. And so I don't know how familiar you are with My Little Pony, but she got the rarity voice. And so she was my favorite character to read for.
Oh, to be a fly on the wall.
Yeah.
Of you reading in the rarity voice. That is hilarious.
It was super fun. All right, girls, I know you each came up with a question to ask Mary Rose. Sloan, do you want to ask your question first? Do you remember what it was? I can see the wheels turning.
I bet it was a really good question. I hope I can answer it.
How did you come up with the idea of the Mahler?
Oh, what a great question, Sloan. So she's asked me how I've come up with the idea of the Mahler. And I'll spell that because it may be not be evident what word that is. It's kind of a word I invented for the book. So Mahler is M-A-U-L-E-R. Now the word maul is it's a word that describes a kind of a destructive attack, right? It's a word that has a little bit of bad news built into it. And in the world of the rabbits, the idea that they have of what happens sometimes to the land is that this really terrifying, extremely noisy thing called the Mahler shows up and just digs up the earth, knocks down the trees, tears up all the plants, flattens everything out. And then often after the Mahler is done destroying everything, people come and make it all hard and black and smooth, and probably what you and I would call a parking lot, or maybe a building like a mini storage, or a shopping center. But the animals have their own way of explaining it because that's the way they see the world. So they think of the Mahler as like kind of a monster. It's often bright yellow. It often has a person riding on its neck.
After.
I didn't hear what you said. Can you say it one more time?
They're afraid of a tractor.
Oh, it sounds like a tractor. Well, you know, a tractor, there is kind of an important tractor character in the book too, isn't there? I don't know if you guys have gotten up to that part yet, but the farmer who lives next door to the Harveys, who turns out to be a really good friend and really helpful to them, Farmer Janice, has a tractor that she has. It's an old tractor that she keeps running, and she calls it Tin Can. Just some people come up with nicknames for their car. She has a nickname for her tractor. So a tractor is a very useful piece of farm machinery. So if you haven't met Tin Can yet, you will. But the kind of machine, right? Construction machine that digs up the earth. There's a couple of different kinds. You know, we could call them bulldozers or earth movers. Anybody who likes construction equipment knows what I'm talking about. But that's what the mauler is. That's what the mauler is to the rabbits. And that is what they fear is going to happen if they do not make sure this farm succeeds. They fear that the mauler will come. So it's really important to Alice that that they have a good harvest when harvest time comes.
Mm-hmm, because we do not want the mauler to come, do we, girls?
No.
Because the egg man is going to be
the mean egg man is going to bring his mauler. Delaney, do you remember what your question was going to be?
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
How did you come up with the names and stuff for the little bunnies?
Right. Well, you know, I was trying to give most of the characters names that the rabbit characters all have names that are connected in some way to plants. So Thistle obviously is Thistle. And Alice is named after Sweet Alice, which is a kind of a common name, a folk name for a pretty plant that has white flowers. And there's another rabbit named Violet, right, who's named after a flower. And then there are a couple of other rabbits as well who all have names that are reminiscent of plants. But the here's a fun story. Can I tell you a fun story about how I got Lester's name?
Because I was just thinking, was Lester a plant?
Lester, right. So Lester, I don't want to be spoilerish because I know you guys haven't finished the book, but Lester is the name that I came up with for that character because I just knew in my heart that he was Lester. And don't ask me how I knew, but he just, you know, I was writing it. I was being creative. I don't know. And I was like, I think this character's name is Lester, but I know that I want all the rabbits to have plant names. So I just am going to trust that I'm going to figure it out. Like if maybe Lester's the wrong name and I'll change it later. But I will, let me just write him as Lester because it really, really came to me that that's what his name was. Well, wouldn't you know, I have some books. You're going to laugh. This is a true story. I'm not making this up. I have some books about gardening that I bought when I lived in Brooklyn, just like the Harveys do in the book. And I used to go to the Brooklyn Botanic Garden all the time with my kids because it was one of my favorite places in Brooklyn. And I would go and I would, you know, see all the plants and we just always have such a great time. And they had a series of gardening books that were so beautiful. They're just really beautifully illustrated. They're these little paperback books and they had a whole series of them. And I started to collect them. And I still have them. It's been many years since I lived in Brooklyn, but I still have all my beautiful little paperback gardening books from the Brooklyn Botanic Garden. And I was looking in one of those books and I found that there was a type of tomato called Lester's Perfected. And I'm not going to say much more, but I just want you to know that sometimes inspiration comes from the most unexpected places. And I thought, got it. That's going to explain his name. And it inspired a whole, you know, bit of information that's in the book. And when you get to it, you're going to know exactly what I'm talking about.
I love that. I love it when the research like brings everything together and you're suddenly like, oh, there was something right in the universe when I chose that.
Oh, don't you think it happens a lot? It's such a great moment.
It's so magical.
It's so magical. I've had that happen so often. I do a lot of research, you know, when I write. And because I often find that it's so inspiring, either the things that I learned that I didn't know that I can use that give me ideas, but sometimes it's just exactly this kind of thing, which is where you have an intuitive impulse and you can't explain it, but it's just shining. It's got a light around it. And you just know, no, that's something I really need to look into. And it may take a little while to find out what it means, but there it is. Yeah. And you're like, well, see, that was it. I was right all along. Love it when that happens. That's truly the acts of the muse. People talk about the muse, you know, where ideas come from. But when those moments happen, I feel so much delight and pleasure in the work.
Yeah, I do too. No, it's one of my favorite things about writing. And just like very quickly backtrack, just to kind of your character names in general, because I have to say, we've got this dog named Foxy. When we meet the fox named Doggo, all three of us absolutely cracked up. I thought that was the funniest thing.
I'm glad. I thought it was funny too. Yeah. Now listen, you know what a Shiba Inu looks like, right? I mean, if you have a, you don't know.
It's pictured on the back of the cover. I've shown them multiple times.
Multiple times. If you look at for pictures of Shiba Inus, you'll see that they actually look a great deal like foxes, that's actually quite true.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see the picture? Are you looking at it now?
We do have it. Yep.
Okay. So they look a lot like foxes. And once again, I was writing from my own experience of having a Shiba Inu. I had a Shiba Inu dog as a pet. Now, her name was not Foxy. Her name was Lil. But she looked so much like a fox, which is, you know, normal for a little Shiba Inu, that it was inevitable that when I would take her out, whoever we would meet would say, look, she looks like a little fox. I have known many Shiba owners, and some of them actually do name their dogs Foxy because it's just such an obvious call. But even if your dog isn't named Foxy, if you walk a Shiba around in public, people will say, oh my goodness, she looks like a little fox. It's what they all say. But so much of the book, you know, has to do with these encounters between, you know, beings, creatures, whether animal or human, who are meeting across a kind of a distance of misunderstanding, you know, that they come from the city and they don't know what to expect about people who live in the country, or they think that farm dogs are a certain way. And then it turns out that this particular farm dog is nothing the way that rabbits expect, right? And Foxy is a city dog and who is very vain, right? She's very proud of how fox-like she is. She thinks she's really cute and she looks, you know, she's mistaken for a little fox and that's her name. When she is let loose in the country and is off leash for the very first time, when she encounters a real fox, that is a huge moment for her because she's never seen a real fox. She thought of herself as being fox-like, but what does it feel like to, you know, encounter a real fox? So they have a wonderful friendship. Foxy the dog and the dog and the fox named Doggo have a really fun friendship. It gets really kind of profound by the end. And I think it's a kind of one of those productive identity crises that happens. You know, they both end up having a much enlarged sense of who they are because they meet, like they look through the mirror, right? And see, wait a minute, you're like me, but not, right? Like,
oh, that's fun.
These are the ways we're alike, but we're so different. You know, how do we get past all of that?
Yeah. All right, girls, you have been so good and patient. I'm going to set you free. Do you have anything else you want to say to Mary Rose? No, do you want to say goodbye and thank you?
Bye.
Bye.
Okay, well, I need to get my, they've been drawing all over my notes now, so I have to reorganize here. Well, I just know for me as a parent, I have had such a wonderful time reading this to them, largely because, you know, it's a very kid-friendly book, of course, and it's, you know, the cute little story about rabbits and farming and all of these great animals. But there has also been just like so many things that opened up discussion with us. And, you know, talking about property development and what does it feel like to move into a new home? And there's a lot of mention in the beginning of the book of how Carl's dad received a golden parachute. And so there was like, how do I explain what a golden parachute is to 6-year-olds?
But it's time they knew.
Right? I know this is relevant information for you. And so it's just been one of those books that has just provided a ton of great fodder for us as a family to give us new things to talk about. And I love that. It's really made the whole experience really fun.
Oh, that feels so good to hear, Marissa. I'm glad your guys are having that experience with it. And I love a book that's a good family read. I feel that that's one of the things that I love about writing middle grade, mm-hmm. that a middle grade book can offer that to a family, that there's something about that space that you can, if you put your mind to it, write a story that is just completely accessible to a 6 or 7 year old listener, right? Because often these books get read aloud or are listened to on audiobook. That's such a big thing. But mom and dad and older siblings and even younger siblings are not going to be left out of the fun, that there's multiple layers mm-hmm. of experience available in the book. And if a book makes a family have interesting conversations, that to me is wonderful. So I'm glad. But that's also a salute to you as a very good mom and a good a read aloud mom, right? That you can see when to stop and draw out a conversation. I mean, that does make it a very rich experience.
Well, thank you. I'm certainly trying. But no, I mean, it is one of those books that I think kind of defies age expectation, because, you know, it is a middle grade book. I can absolutely see, you know, a fourth or fifth grader reading and enjoying this book, but my 6-year-olds are absolutely loving it. And for me as an adult, like, there's so many little hidden things and inside jokes that, you know, a kid isn't going to get, but they're hysterical. And so I just really appreciate that.
Oh, good. Well, you got to throw in something for the parents. I mean, if you're going to read aloud a book to your kids, you know, I mean, I have to keep the parents entertained.
Yeah.
Kind of along these lines, you know, the parents in many children's books are kind of off stage. And in this book, that's not the case so much, right? Because the plight of the Harvey family is very central. The rabbits are trying to save the farm, but the Harveys are also in their own way trying to save the farm. And so we see all of them doing the best, trying to learn how to make it work. Carl, of course, is the kid, and he has a baby sister, Marie, who was, I have to say, as much fun to write as any character I've ever written.
I really love Marie.
To include the perspective, you know, you see, once you have talking animals, like, all rules are off. Am I right? So mm-hmm. you can have a baby as a character in the book, if you decide to do so, and I did. And Marie is a really central, important character. And I just don't know how many baby characters there are in middle grade, but Marie is one of them. And she's going to be very important to the plot in her own sweet little way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so that is actually one thing I wanted to talk about specifically, is you do have just this breadth of characters, and they are all so vibrant and interesting. And of course, half of them are animals. And so we're getting just all of these great perspectives. How does a bunny rabbit see the world? And how is that different from how a dog sees the world versus a kid who just moved from the city? And how is he envisioning all of this? And you did such a great job with it. And I just was so pleased to be in all of these different points of view. I really felt like I understand bunny rabbits more now, and I understand farm dogs more now. So for you as a writer, kind of getting into more craft stuff, what strategies did you use, or how were you thinking about that when you were trying to bring all of these various voices to life?
Oh, I love this question. I nerd out on writing craft. I just need to tell you that. I just love
good.
It.
You're so in the right place.
I nerd out. I teach writing craft. I mean, this is something that's really important to me. You know, as I've gotten older, to just kind of put on my little hat as mentor and try to help other writers, you know, learn all the things I learned the hard way a little more quickly than I learned them. So I like to help out. So I love to talk about this stuff. So what you're asking about, I'm going to answer by talking about the point of view of the book, because that is really the question, right? Mm. So many writers are like, well, what point of view should I use to write my book? And there's first person and there's third person. And sometimes the exploration stops there. And, this could not be written in a first person point of view, could it? Right? There's so many perspectives, and the interplay between the perspectives is what the book is about. The book is thematically, I would say. It is about interconnectedness. It's about how we, you know, this is the system of nature. Nothing is independent. If one thing fails, it ripples throughout. And the metaphor of the food chain ripples throughout the book in that way, because if, you know, there's a character who appears later on in the book who is an American bald eagle. Mm-hmm. And his name is John Glenn, for reasons that are explained in the book, that is his name. And, you know, the story of the American bald eagle was that they almost went extinct in the Hudson Valley, not because people were necessarily bothering the eagles, but because the water in the Hudson River got so polluted that the fish died and the fish were poisonous, right? The fish became toxic and eagles eat fish. And so by having something bad happen at one part of the food chain, it ripples all the way up, right? And, you know, you can talk about global warming. You can talk about all these kinds of systemic issues, right? We can see how this works in real life. So when we choose a point of view for a book, it's not just like, oh, I feel like telling it from the point of view of that character, or I feel like, you know, it's not necessarily what you feel like. What story are you telling? Thematically, like the point of view has an impact on the feeling of the book. And this book was about interconnectedness. And so to write from what we would call an omniscient third person point of view was the only way that I could see forward to do it. Now, nowadays, people consider, I think, an omniscient third person to be kind of a rare bird. A lot of kids' fiction is written in first person. A lot of people think that kids like first-person narratives or find them easier to read. You know, there's a lot of things that are said that I don't necessarily sign off on. I think that if you understand your reader, you understand, you know, what you're trying to accomplish, you can sit down and write an omniscient third-person point of view like, you know, it's Tolstoy, man. It's just, this is a big classical construction for a book, right? It pivots from place to place. It pivots from character to character. It goes from the human world to the animal world and back again and all over the place, right? And that was something that I have to tell you, I had so much fun. I was like a kid in a candy store. Now, I just name dropped Tolstoy, which is like totally pretentious, but I have to tell you that the masterclass in writing in an omniscient third person is Charlotte's Web.
Mm.
It is, you know, one of our classic, like great middle grade books of all time. And it is written gorgeously in an omniscient third person narrator that is quite sophisticated and complicated. And any third grader, right, can get through Charlotte's Web. So we need to look at our technique, right? And because if you can make it work, it will work. And it will work even for a young reader. You know, the trick of writing with a lot of different perspectives is to have a kind of a grasp of close third person so that your reader always knows where you are in terms of which character is in the spotlight at that moment. That's what you have to be careful of.
Yeah. Were you already very familiar with farming and, you know, these various animals? Like, did you already know a lot about bunny rabbits and their lifespan and, you know, all of these things? Or was there a ton of research involved?
There was a ton of research involved. There was a ton. Now, one of the mentor texts, we'll call it, one of my inspo books, one was Charlotte's Web, obviously. I definitely wanted to write like a 21st take on life on a farm. But Watership Down was a book that I loved as a teenager. And that to me was an example of how you could write a really challenging, epic adventure with rabbits. And you know, we're calling it the bunny book and we're calling them bunny rabbits, right? But and my book is cute and funny and it's, as you say, you know, and I appreciate you saying it, it's totally kid friendly, but these are not bunny rabbits. These are Eastern cottontails, right? Like these are actual, you know, if you take away the society that I invent for them, their lifespan, their habits, the way their nervous systems work, the concerns that they have are authentic. They're, because this is a book about nature. And so I needed the animals to function plausibly as part of the natural system of this farm. One of the things that you guys discovered today with your adventure was that rabbits are extremely vulnerable, and that that they are designed to compensate for that. A rabbit doesn't have a lot of weaponry, right? A rabbit has a physical capacity to run away, to sense danger coming, and to flee. That's what a rabbit's defense mechanism is. It has an exquisite capacity to be terrified and to bolt. The way they stay alive is by hiding and by knowing when danger is coming and by being able to run away. And they also breed really fast because you have to replace bunnies quick because, you know, they're very vulnerable. So this kind of factual information about them was really a clue for me as to how they would be philosophically. What is, you know, the spiritual life of a rabbit, when you are very in touch with your own mortality, what kind of worldview do you have? And that's something that I tried to introduce, you know, as part of the way the rabbits think, that they know and are comfortable with the fact that life is short and sweet in a way that we, you know, humans with our larger brains and our larger capacity for denial don't like to think about. And so my research, I mean, that was the question you asked. I did a ton of research, but it really informed way more than just the facts of the matter. Yes, this is the lifespan of the rabbit. This is what they like to eat. This, you know, this is the kind of burrows that they live in, blah, blah, blah. But it made me think about what they would be like.
Mm-hmm. No, and I really like that. And I felt that it adds so much depth and authenticity because you really do take, like you say, these facts, the basics of what is life like for a bunny rabbit, but then you dig so much deeper into how that would affect personalities and their society and their culture. And I mean, it really felt very thought out and very real.
Well, that's nice to hear. And I did not grow up as a farmer, by the way, but I grew up around farming. And I do think that I have to give a little shout out to my Italian grandparents who were immigrants, who were, you know, peasant farmers in Italy and came over to the United States, as so many did, in the 1930s, and ended up some decades later through very hard work, having a little house in the suburbs that my grandfather then proceeded to farm. You know, everyone else has got like a pool and a, you know, badminton court in the backyard. My grandfather had a bocce court and he did everything else was just vegetables. So I grew up really fortunate in that we would go to my grandparents' house, which is just a few minutes away from ours. And we'd go in the back and it was just a farm and everything was grown fresh. And we just grew up thinking that's what vegetables tasted like.
Yeah.
And so I've always loved it. It really gave me a lifelong passion for growing things, for gardening, for good food, fresh food. You know, nothing makes me happier than to see that people are more aware now of, you know, what we call farm to table, buying directly from farmers, the problems that farmers have, you know, economically, the impact on the environment, all of these things. You know, where would we be without them? Like, yeah. Look at your plate. That's one thing I hope everyone would think about after reading this book. Like if you ate today, thank a farmer for sure.
Mm-hmm.
That's really something to consider.
No. And again, as a parent, I think it's really important to introduce kids to fresh food and healthy food. And we have a vegetable garden. We skipped it this year because life was just too busy. But in the past, the girls, it was one of their favorite things to go out and just, you know, pick a fresh cherry tomato and chomp it right there in the garden, or, you know, pick some fresh sugar snap peas. And I think that's a really special thing to be able to do that.
Oh, nothing tastes as good as something you grew yourself.
Oh,
that's so great. I'm so glad for your girls that they have that experience. How wonderful.
And I did, while we were reading a couple days ago, Delaney requested that I buy radishes the next time I'm at the grocery store. Okay.
Oh, that's so great. Oh, I'm so glad. Yeah, in the book, Alice, she really wants to taste a radish. Mm-hmm. That's one of her goals, you know.
Yeah, Lester really talks up the fresh vegetables, which I appreciate as a mom.
Exactly. Thank you, Lester.
Yeah.
Thank you, Lester.
So I want to back up to something you mentioned before, talking about writing for kids, but doing it in a really sophisticated way. Because that was one of the things that I felt was maybe most surprising for me about this book, is that it's, targeting at a young age group, but the language that you've chosen to use is very lush and very descriptive. There are words in this book that I didn't know. And I really got this feeling that you as the writer, I'm making an assumption here and you can correct me, but I almost feel like you made the decision. I don't care if they don't know what this word is. I don't care if they don't understand what a golden parachute is or whatever this concept is. I want this to feel very lush and to not shy away from using really sophisticated language. And I loved that. And I was not expecting it.
Oh, well, I'm glad that you end up loving it. And I'm glad that you noticed it and talked about it, because anybody who knows the Incorrigible Children of Ashton Place books, right? That's a series of 6 books. And it's very different, obviously. It's a series. It takes place in Victorian England. It's, it's not contemporary farm life. It's not an animal tale, right? But the word incorrigible is in the series title. So, I lay my cards on the table up front. If that's going to bother you, maybe these are not the books. But I got, I was made confident by the readers of that series that the use of language was one of the things that they loved about it. And it gave me confidence that my impulse, my intuition, that I should not in any way dumb down or scale back what kind of storytelling and what quality of writing craft and richness of depiction, I would say, mm-hmm. That I wanted to bring to the table for young readers, that they deserve the best that I could do and that they would appreciate it. Now, there is some really interesting neuroscience that I also believe in, by the way, and it is something, again, that to me makes it really delicious to write middle grade, is that our brains before puberty are language acquisition machines, that is in fact one of the things that our brains are designed to be best at when we're quite young. We absorb language like a sponge absorbs water. And it is when people, so after the puberty happens and, we get into the teen years, that starts to change. Our brains obviously change as the bodies change. And it's one of the reasons that if you learn multiple languages, not only your native tongue, but perhaps a second language when you're quite young, that you can grow up quite effortlessly multilingual and speak all of the languages that you know like a native. But if you pick up a second language or study it later in life, in high school or in college, you are likely, no matter how fluent you become, to have an accent. The brain does not quite have the facility later in life as it does. So the moral of this, as far as I'm concerned, is that middle grade readers we should throw all of the words at them. Like there's never a better time for kids to learn language. Mm-hmm. And when, we talk about vocabulary, there's nothing like technical. They're just the words. They're just delicious words. I use the words that I know. I try to choose the best word to mean what I want it to mean. But I am aware that, and I consider this a hallmark of good writing, that if the context doesn't make the meaning of the word clear, then I need to work on it a little bit more. Because you don't want people lost. You don't want the reader to say, I don't know what's going on. You want them to be able to surmise enough of what the word means that they don't feel that they need to stop and say, I don't understand what this means. They get it. It just becomes part of the tune of the language, and the meaning will be absorbed. You know, it'll get there. I love words. I mean, you know, being a writer, I think language is to be able to use the full palette of words in English, which is a remarkably rich language, because it's such a hodgepodge. English has stolen so many words from so many other languages that it's just glorious, rich hodgepodge. It would be like being a painter, but I'm only going to use primary colors. Like, no, mix them. Right. Use all the colors, you know, use all the colors.
Yeah, no, I so appreciate you talking about that and giving that feedback, because I know we, of course, have lots of aspiring writers who listen to this, and a lot who are writing for younger audiences. And I mean, I think that in a lot of ways, even for like getting down into like picture book writing, there is this inclination to simplify sometimes. And you know, you don't want things going over your reader's head. But I much prefer your take on it, is that it's important to challenge and to, you know, teach, not in a didactic way, but like, this is your opportunity to expand your reader's vocabulary and, you know, give them the full effect of language. And it's really done spectacularly in this book and has made me a fan big time. And I just loved reading it out loud. Like, it was one of those books that was just fun. There's just so many fun, playful, descriptive words. It just made the whole experience really enjoyable.
Oh, that's so wonderful. I thank you from the bottom of my heart. That's such high praise, and coming from you, it means a great deal to me to hear that. Thank you.
Okay, Mary Rose, we are now going to start wrapping this up with our Happy Writer bonus round.
A bonus round. I'm excited.
Bonus.
Bonuses.
Okay. Tea or coffee?
Oh, coffee. All day long. Coffee. Really strong coffee, I might add.
I got to admit, I thought you were going to be a tea person.
I don't mind tea. I'll drink it. I mean, I will. I have lots of flavors of tea. I sometimes like a cup of tea. If I've had so much coffee that having more coffee would really be embarrassing, I will switch to tea.
You've been, but I off. Like,
and I'm going to come right out and say it. This is not a paid endorsement. I'm a Peet's fan. I like my Peet's coffee, French roast. This is dark, bold coffee.
Mm. Puppy dog or bunny rabbit?
Oh, gosh, that's a tough one. Well, I'm going to say puppy dog. In my family, we have had beloved dogs and we have had beloved rabbits. So, you know, we've had those experiences of both. But I think if I were inclined at this stage of my life, I would go with puppy dog.
Plotter or pantser?
You got to have both. You got to have both. I can't choose one and be honest. So I'm just going to quickly say that every writer does both. It's simply a question of which you do first.
That's an interesting take on it. Which do you do first?
A very gentle plotting. Okay. Gentle plotter. I don't write outlines, but I do. I think about story structure a great deal.
Mm-hmm. Writing in the morning or writing at night?
100% morning, morning, morning. By noon, it's done. It's over by noon.
Oh, for me on the good days, yes.
Oh my goodness! The afternoons we save for like paying the bills and washing the dishes. The brain is done. It's done. Sometimes there's like a little like second wind right before dinner, but no, writing is great in the morning.
What is your favorite writing snack?
Does coffee count?
It can. Yeah.
It's probably the only thing I actually indulge in while I'm writing. But if I am really up against it, and I mean really up against it, dark chocolate.
Oh, nice. What book makes you happy?
Oh, so many of them. I will throw Jane Eyre into the mix. Mm-hmm. I will throw Jane Eyre in. And The Hobbit.
Two classic choices.
Mm-hmm.
What are you working on next?
Oh, I'm glad you asked. I just turned in a manuscript for a new book to my agent this week. And she and I had a conversation this morning about it. So what I'm working on next is another middle grade book. The working title is Bad Badger. And I will be excited to share news about it as it comes to market. So I'm going to be working on some revisions to the manuscript and hopefully the second book in that world coming up.
Awesome. And I love the title.
Thank you.
Lastly, where can people find you?
People can find me online at my website, which is maryrosewood.com. And that's where the information about my books lives. But if you're a grown-up writer and you want to nerd out with me about writing craft and story structure, you can find that side of my brain at pathofthestoryteller.com, mm-hmm. which is where I teach and mentor, and I have my own program called Path of the Storyteller. And it's just it's something that's become really important to me to share, you know, my hard-won wisdom as much as I can to help other writers tell their stories. That's it. I guess I'm on Instagram too, but I'm not a huge social media person, but those are the best places to find me. Oh, and I should say, by the way, I also do content for kids that is, you noted the possibility of having good conversations based on my books. And this is something that's, I really enjoy. It's just something I like to double down on. And so I actually started a program called the Swanburn Academy, which is derived from my Incorrigible Children of Ashton Place books. And so if you go to www.swanburnacademy.com, that is a whole other opportunity to find like educational content that is derived whimsically from the books. It's actually a great deal of fun. I love creating content for the Swanburn Academy.
Oh, how fun. And I have to say that I did not realize that you were the author of The Incorrigible Children of Ashton Place. And then when I was looking at your website this morning and I came across that and I was like, oh, we have that first book on our shelf waiting to be read. So I was already excited. I've heard really good things about this series and now I'm even more excited.
Well, I'm excited too, because now I know you're going to like the big words in it, Marissa.
I love the big words.
you can take your girls after you finish with that, Alice's Farm and the Incorrigible Children. You go right to the SAT test. If they still give that, I don't even know if they still give it, but you know, the vocab words will be solid. They
awesome. Be That's what solid. We're going for.
Very good. Very good.
Excellent. Mary Rose, thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, this is such a lovely conversation. What a treat. I'm so, so grateful for this conversation and for your lovely and insightful questions. It's really a delight chatting with you.
It has been a lot of fun, and I'm glad that the girls were able to join us as well. I hope they were able to find their father and aren't up to no good as we speak right now.
I have a question. I have a question for you. How do you get any work done with such cuteness running around the house?
Oh, it's not always easy.
I bet. Oh, they are just darling. They're just adorable.
Yeah, no, they are. They're great kids. Let's see. Readers, definitely check out Alice's Farm, A Rabbit's Tale. It is available now. Of course, we encourage you to support your local independent bookstore if you can. If you don't have a local indie, you can check out our affiliate store at bookshop.org/shop/Marissa Meyer. Coming up next week, I will be talking to Sarah Rothley about her new historical fantasy, The Bones of Ruin. It is spectacular. It's coming out on September 7th, and I hope you will give the episode a listen. If you're enjoying these conversations, please subscribe and follow us on Instagram at Marissa Meyer Author and at Happy Writer Podcast. Until next time, stay healthy, stay cozy, and whatever life throws at you today, I hope that now you're feeling a little bit happier.